All right, we're getting here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Tzadi Zayin Amud Bet. The Mishnah says, "Amucher yain lechaviro," person who sells wine to his friend, "vechmitz," and then it goes bad, it turns into vinegar. "Enu chayav b'achriyuto," the seller has no responsibility vis-a-vis the wine that he sold him. "V'miyadua sheyenu machmitz," if it's well known that this seller's wine goes bad, it turns into vinegar. "Harizeh mekach taot," then it is a problematic sale. The sale can be reversed. It's a question of after the fact, it's circumstantial evidence that we find that the remainder of his wine also went bad. So that's good evidence of the fact that it wasn't the responsibility of the buyer. It wasn't caused by the buyer, it was caused by the seller, because we have other wines of this seller are all in the same circumstance or situation. If he says, "I'm selling you flavored wine," although the way that the Rishonim explained it over here, you could see this in the Rabbeinu Gershom. At first, he says that it's actually on the way, way bottom of the Amud here. Yain Mivusam is Yain Mufchar V'tov. It's really good and excellent quality wine. The way that the Rishbam explains it is Shit Kayim Derech Hamit Kayimim. It's excellent wine because of its ability to last for a long time, that it won't go bad, it won't sour over time. So if he specifies that he's looking for this high quality, really long-lasting wine, chayav lamid lo ad atzeret, then the requirement is that the wine has to sustain itself as wine until Shavuot. And therefore, it seems that the heat of the summer makes it almost impossible that the wine will last through the summer. And therefore, there's no warranty on the wine. So even in the situation where the seller is saying that this is yayin mevusam, it's high quality wine, implicit in that is that it'll last until the summertime. If you're ready to keep it over the summertime, then you sign your own risk that you do that. V'yashan, if he says, "I want to buy old wine, aged wine," mishel eshtekad, that means last year's wine. U'miyushan, if not just old, but I want really aged wine, mishel gimel shanim, that's 3 years. The way that the Rashbam explains it over here doesn't literally mean 3 years, because you just went from yashan, which was last year, to miyushan. So miyushan just means an additional year, which means from 2 years ago, but it's 3 years, including the year then when you're in. So given that, then you have a sequence in the Mishnah, which is that mivusam means that wine will last through the entire season this year, from the batsir, all the way from the time of the harvest, until atzeret, until Shavuot. If you're buying older wine, you're saying that it was a wine that already went through 1 year cycle, and now it'll last in this next year, the entire year. We'll see in the Gemara, that means until Sukkot. And if you buy shel miyushan, means it's already gone through 2 years of cycles, and then in the year that you're purchasing it, it will last until Sukkot, it'll make its third year. So that's the definition of these items when someone's selling them. If they are labeled in this fashion, that's the warranty or the implicit warranty that comes with them. The Mishnah itself and the subsequent Gemara that we're about to read has a significant question as to how it relates to the machloket of Rav and Shmuel that we saw before, where Rav said that the first 3 days, it is Bershut Mocher. After that, it's in the Rishut of the Lokeach. And Shmuel said that immediately it's a problem of the Lokeach, because Akatfa Nemare is Shavar, because it's on the shoulders of the individual. And we saw the interpretations of the Rishinim over there. The question is, how does this Mishnah relate to that Machloket? Many see this Mishnah as being a support for Shmuel's position. But that makes it difficult. Why was Rav arguing on a Mishnah? What's Rav going to do with this Mishnah? And you can see that difficulty or that tension already on the previous Amud, on Sadi Zayin Amud Bet, in the bottom of the Rabbeinu Gershom. He says, "Milta de Rav Shmuel plige le'el b'chavit shechmitza. Kashali v'chi lo savrelu hachmat nitin." What happened to this Mishnah? Didn't they know this Mishnah? Over here, you have a clear statement in the Mishnah. Why doesn't the Gemara relate to this Mishnah at all? Our teacher told us that they don't hold like this Mishnah. This Mishnah is not shayach to them. So it's interesting. Why don't they hold like this Mishnah? It means they must have brayto, they must have other opinions that they follow. The Rashbam, earlier on, we saw connected very heavily between Rav and Shmuel and our Gemara over here, with regards to what we're going to see in a second. And the Baal Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam, went out of his way to show that these machlokot are different, and that the issues that are brought up here are different than the issues brought up over there. again, it's a huge discussion in the Rishonim. We're not going to delve into it. I just want to make you aware of the fact you can see that tension in the Rabbeinu Gershom, that this Gemara and the Machloket Rav and Shmuel before, you have to reconcile between them, either create, say that they're talking about different instances, or say that this Gemara then is a proof, like one of the two opinions. It's only true if it's in the utensils of the buyer. Aval b'kankanim democher, if they're in the utensils of the seller, amalei hachamarcha v'hakankanecha. Here is your wine back, and here is your utensil back. You can just hand him back and say, harishelcha lefanecha. I didn't do anything. It's your wine. It's your barrels. There was no contribution on my part to the deterioration of the wine. And of course, it's your problem. I'm handing it back to you. So the statement of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina is that the problem here was the kankanim de lokeach. It's the fact that it went into the utensils of the lokeach. And we're assuming now that what the mocher will say is, well, if it went into the kankanim of the lokeach, then there is a contribution by you. You kept it in a bad kli. You didn't treat it properly, or whatever it is, you can make a claim with regards to the wine. That is true when the lokeach has something that he has done that could change the dynamic of how the wine is kept. But once you say that it's in the kankanim of the mocher, then you have a reason to believe that the lokeach had no contribution towards the deterioration of the wine over here, because it remained in the same utensil, and it was the mocher's wine. And you can see at the end of the Reshbam here, of Abba Kanigim de mocher, Rav damar le'el, kol shosha yamim b'shut mocher, ikal ukmei matritin b'kankanim de lokeach. Rav, who said before that the first 3 days, it's the responsibility of the mocher, you can set up our Mishnah in a case that it's the kankanim of the lokeach, it's the buyer's kelim, v'afilu toch shlosha. And even within 3 days, he still believes it's the mocher's problem. Oh, because kanim shemocher ulachar shlosha. Or the Mishnah is talking about the utensils of the mocher, but it's after 3 days. So you have the ways that he's trying to reconcile. You can see again between Rav and Shmuel and our Gemara over here. Now Gemara says, v'chi kam kanim de mocher my havi. Just because it's in the utensils of the mocher, what does that change? Lemaloi loli baylach l'shuye. The seller can say to him, why'd you keep it around? Why'd you keep the wine for any duration of time? When I sold you the wine, I assumed that you're going to drink it immediately. Not only that, the majority of wine is sold for the purpose of being used in a very short period of time. Most people aren't buying wine to store it for the long duration. Most people are buying the wine to use it immediately. So the seller can say, I assumed you're going to use it immediately. Now you're coming back to me, it's a month later, and you're saying it went bad. I didn't expect you to keep it for a month. Lo tzricha, damarlei the mikpeh. So here you have him say explicitly that he wanted to keep it for the long duration. So the Gemara sets it up here with an equimta that it's the mikpeh. The mikpeh, as we explained before, is for cooking purposes. And when you use wine for cooking purposes, by definition, you're going to use it over a long duration. Just, you don't use so much of it each time. You dip into it where you're cooking in each instance, but that means that it's going to be around for a long time. So now that the buyer specified he's buying it for duration, the seller can no longer say, I sold you wine to be used immediately, because it was stated explicitly that that was not the case. Umay duchke de Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina. What pressured Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina to explain our Mishnah in that manner? Lokma lamatznitin mekankanim de lokeach. To explain that it's a case where it's the utensils of the buyer. Udamarle de mikpeh. And it's a case where he said that it's for the long duration. Lokma bekankanim de mocher. Let him set up the Mishnah with the utensils of the seller. In a case where he didn't specify that he was going to utilize it for the long duration. So now, what's interesting over here is that you have two options about how to explain the Mishnah. You have to come up with a reason why the mocher is off the hook. It's because either they were transferred into the utensils of the lokeach, and since they were transferred into the utensils of the lokeach, we say that the lokeach was a contributor to the problem. And then the Gemara said, hey, what does it have to do with the lokeach? Even in the utensils of the mocher, it should be a problem because he didn't sell it to him for a long duration. The Gemara answered to that, oh, the mikpeh. So they set up the Mishnah in a case where it went into the utensils of lokeach and where he had specified he wanted it to last for a long duration. So that's the explanation, implying that if it was in the utensils of the mocher, then it would have been the problem of the mocher. On the other hand, you could have just simply explained the Mishnah as being a case where it was the utensils of the mocher, but he never explicitly said that he wanted to keep it for a duration. And then the mocher can say, why did you keep it around? What made you keep it around when you never specified that you wanted to keep it around? I gave you wine that would last for you to drink it quickly. I didn't give you wine that was going to last that duration. You could have solved the problem. So the Gemara's question is, what compelled Rabbi Yosef ben Chanina to say we're talking about the lokeach utensil with him saying that it's the mikpeh versus just saying it was the mocher's kelim and not the mikpeh? You would have had the same result. Amarova matnitin kashite. The Mishnah was problematic and it compelled him to go in that direction. Diktani, because of the next piece of the Mishnah. Im yadua sheyenu machmitz, if we know that his wine goes back, harizem makach taut, then it's clearly a problematic sale. It was sold under the wrong premises, and given that, they can reverse the sale. Amai, why is that the case? Lemelei, lo yibaylach lishuye. You can say to him, why'd you keep it around? Meaning that even if all of his wine went bad, that shouldn't change the fact that when the buyer bought it, it was wine. Then if he had used it right away, it still would have been wine. The fact that he kept it around is now contributing to the fact that there is vinegar here instead of wine. Then the seller has a claim against the buyer, which would then free him of any obligation or any warranty. Elalav shmamina, it must be, damar le mikpeh shmamina, must be that that second case in the Mishnah is a case where the buyer specified he wanted to keep it around. So now the mocher, now the seller has no claim. The seller says to him, he shouldn't have kept it around. He says, I told you I'm going to use it over the long duration. Once he does that, and then there's this circumstantial evidence that the rest of the wine of the seller all went bad, that's a good indication that it had nothing to do with the buyer and everything to do with the seller. Given that explanation of this second piece of the Mishnah, that's what compelled Rabbi Yosef ben Chanina to explain the first piece in that manner. That the first piece is a case where it went into the kelim of the lokeach, and even though he had said the mikpeh, it's still no warranty because of the fact that it is in the kelim of the lokeach. And then this will go back to what we saw with Rabbi Shmuel as to what exactly the problem is over here with regards to putting it into the kli of the lokeach. Is it the problem of the tiltul, as we saw over there? That's what the Rabbeinu Tam had suggested. That was the carrying of the wine, the movement of the wine that caused the problem. Well, others say, well, if that's the case, why does it matter if it's in the keli of the lokeach versus in the keli of the mocher? Might be that there is a difference that once you pour it into the other keli, that it causes a lot of movement. And that brought us to the other explanation. It wasn't the movement itself, but rather the pouring of the wine from the keli of the mocher into the keli of the lokeach, which causes the problem. So you have different ways to explain what the issue is with regards to the keli of the lokeach. But nevertheless, that's the way Rabbi Yosef ben Chanina came about his position because he was compelled by the second case of the Mishnah to say that he had stated it was the mikpeh. And if he had stated the mikpeh and it stayed in the kelim of the mocher, that the mocher would be responsible for it. So the only way to make him not responsible is to say it moved over to the kelim of the lokeach in that first case in the Mishnah. Gemara now brings the dissenting opinion, which is Upliga de Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef. This position of Rabbi Yosef bar Rabbi Chanina is in dissension with that of Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef. Dam Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef, Chamra Mazla de More Gorim. The mazel of any individual is what causes the wine to do well or the wine to spoil. It has nothing to do with how you treat the wine. It has to do with the merits and demerits of the individual who owns the wine. Now, obviously, if you're negligent with the wine, then there is responsibility for that, and you can't blame it on the merits or demerits of the individual. On the other hand, if you do everything properly, and the wine either is good or bad, that will be depend on the individual's mazal. As we saw back by the case of the machloket Rav and Shmuel, the Rashbam explains that this is the machloket between Rav and Shmuel. Shmuel says that what does it mean? It's on the shoulder of the individual. It means that it's on the one who buys it. The person who owns it is the one whose mazel is goreim. The other opinions, the majority of Rishonim that argue on him, argue because here the Gemara has a very specific language that it uses. It says, Chamra mazla demare gorim. Then all of a sudden Shmuel has a different way to express it. Chamra katfa demare shavar. Why doesn't Shmuel just quote exactly what Rav Chiya bar Yosef said? And that's for that reason that they believe that Shmuel's opinion back there was different than the opinion of Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef over here, and had nothing to do with the mazel. He proves it, Shenamar, because he brings it from the Pasuk in Chavakuk, V'af ki ayayin bogeid, gever yahir lo yinve. So here, the Pasuk itself, in its pashtut, is hard to translate. The way that the Mitzudah Tzion explains is, V'af ki ayayin bogeid is a koshkein, kal v'chomer. Just like wine rebels, or meaning that wine is treacherous. Wine can be treacherous in two ways. Wine can be treacherous because one who drinks it gets drunk and it's treacherous in that way. Or wine can be treacherous because wine is can spoil or can go bad. It's very delicate. Gever Yahir, a person who is haughty, a person who is arrogant, lo yinveh, will not find an abode or will not find rest in his own place, either because he's so arrogant that he's going around to other places to take other people's things and to live in other places, or the same way that the wine spoils or the wine is treacherous, this person who is arrogant doesn't see the treachery out there, and therefore he's running around in his arrogance and doing all these things without any consideration or without any thought to the results of his actions or what's going to happen to him because of his actions. Rashi over there interprets the pasuk to be speaking about Belshazzar, that Belshazzar in his drunken stupor asks for the clay in Beit HaMikdash to be brought out, and he ends up dying that night, and then the Persian Median Empire overruns Bavel. So he speaks about it in that context, that here the individual is so haughty, he doesn't even see all that's about to befall him because of his drinking. So then the interpretation of the Gemara over here is to explain that Afkia Yain Bogeid is that the wine goes bad. What's the reason that wine goes bad? Giver Yahir lo yinveh, because the person is haughty and therefore he finds no rest. The explanation of the first half of the pasuk comes in the second half of the pasuk. Why does wine go bad? Because of the behavior of the individual. So that's the interpretation of the pasuk. And that's the reason that the mazal impacts. The Rashbam says it's actually a mida keneged mida, which is that if a person is gas libo, a person who is a gaba, that's a person who projects something that they don't have inside of them. They have a false face that they put out to the public, trying to convince people of something that they don't have. And he says that's the same thing about wine that goes bad, which is that on the outside, or it supposedly is wine, but on the inside, it really is chometz, it is vinegar. That's either because the barrels weren't open and they're supposedly wine and now they're vinegar, or even when you open up the barrel, sometimes they taste like wine, but underneath the surface, it's already turning into vinegar and there's a problem. So the Rishbam sees this as being a midah keneged midah, the punishment of the wine for the one who is ghastly bull. So Rav Chiya Bar Yosef says it has nothing to do with whose kelim it is in, it has to do with who owns the wine. That means at the point of transfer of ownership, the problem transfers to the buyer's side, and the buyer then is responsible for anything that happens to the wine because the buyer is the cause at this point in time. Obviously, Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef would agree that once it moves into the kelim of the lokeach, it's the lokeach's problem because the lokeach's kelim could be the cause of the problem. Where he argues is that when it stays in the kelim of the mocher, it stays in the mocher's kelim, then the way that Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanina explained it, you can say, ha, kan kancha, ha, kan marcha. Here's your wine, here's your kankan back, it's all your problem. Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef says you can't say that because there's a problem on the side of the buyer, which is the buyer's mazel is what caused the problem. So even if it remains in the kli of the mocher, the buyer is still responsible. He has no warranty from the mocher at that point in time because of the change in ownership. Again, when you have circumstantial evidence, like in the Mishnah, where there's overwhelming evidence that there was a problem with the wine of the seller, then he can go back and say, look, it can't be my mazel. Look at what's going on with all your wine. And then you would say that the wine already had turned before I bought it. Because the fact that all your wine been bad shows or is indication there was a problem that preceded the sale. All right, with your whole production process. And that's why you'll be responsible, even though now it's in the ownership of the lokeach or the ownership of the buyer. And now the Gemara will continue to darshan that pasuk and says, Amar Rav Mori, I'm under your here, person who is haughty, afilu inche beite lo mikabel. Even by his own household, he's not accepted. Generally, the word inche beite, when you say the household, it includes the wife or it's focused on the wife. And that's what the Rashbam says over here. Even his wife won't accept him. So either the idea being that this person who is haughty and putting out all these pretenses about what he is or trying to convince people of something that he's not only will he not convince other people about it, he won't even convince his own family of that fact. And even the one who's closest to him, his wife, will be mevazeuto, will denigrate him, make fun of him, or not believe in the facade that he's putting on. That's one way to explain it. Or you can explain it that someone who's gaspili bo is someone who lords over other people. And so his lording over other people will include lording over his own household. But not only would the other people not accept his lording over him, even his wife, who is the one that he should be, Moshel Bebeito, the way that the advisors of Ahasuerus say in Megillat Esther, that should have been a given, that if he's lording over his house, that his wife would be someone who would take his authority. Nevertheless, because he is acting this manner, now his wife will even reject his authority or dismiss the fact that he's lording over her. So that's the, again, with some sense, a midah keneged midah, that he's putting on this facade where he's lording over people. And in the end, even the people that should have been convinced by it or the closest to him don't buy his story, and they undermine exactly what he's trying to accomplish. Shneamar. So again, they quote the latter half of our pasuk is Gever Yahir v'lo yinveh. Gever Yahir, the one who is haughty, v'lo yinveh. He does not have an abode. My v'lo yinveh b'naveh shelo. What does it mean that he have no abode or he won't be at home? It means that in his own home, he will not be at home. People of his own household will not accept what he is doing or will denigrate him for what he is doing. Amri Yehuda Merav, kol mitga'eh b'talit shel tamid chacham. Anyone who goes around dressed up and presenting himself like a Tamid Chacham, ve'eino Tamid Chacham, and he's really not a Tamid Chacham, ein machnisin oto b'mchitzato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They don't allow him to enter into the area of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, meaning the Olam Haba. He will not be able to be in that area by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because K'tiv Ocha says over here, v'lo yinveh, gever yahir, v'lo yinveh, v'chtiv otam el nevei kodshecha. And it says in Az Yashir, El Nevei Kodshecha, Gemara's bring in an Agadic Gezer Shava, the word Nevei, Nevei. So not only will you not have your own household here, Kodesh Baruch Hu's holy abode, you will not be allowed to enter, or you will not be able to join over there. So again, the idea being that a person who is presenting credentials that do not represent who the true individual is, Kodesh Baruch Hu will not accept that individual, because Kodesh Baruch Hu does not stand for people who lie or people who present false pretenses about themselves. In terms of what a talit shel tamid chacham is, the Rashbam explains that a tamid chacham wore clothing that was longer than other people because they wore the tunic underneath. The chaluk was underneath. And the tamid chacham wore his outer clothing long enough that it covered the undergarment or the tunic, and so they didn't even show a tefach. That was a certain stature that was presented in that. Other people would have a smaller outer garment, therefore the tunic would protrude from underneath it. So that's part of the idea that Talmidei Chachamim wore longer clothing. The Gemara even speaks about it with regards to Big Day Shabbat. The idea that one should wear something longer on Shabbat than they wear during the weekday. Part of that has to do with work, which is that people who are working need to roll up their sleeves and need to pull up their tunic, in a sense, because they are going to get caught in the mud or the things that they're working with. People who are not working can wear longer sleeves and longer robes because they're not working. And so that was an indication of someone who was in a position of authority, person who was not actually doing the labor themselves, but was a manager of those that were labor. And so Talmud Chacham was in that position of authority, as well as in a position where their job was to be the rav of the city and not to be out in the fields and working, so they could wear this type of clothing. So it was indicative of a certain stature or position, and therefore someone who takes that type of clothing or wears that clothing when it doesn't reflect truly who they are, that is, again, presenting this falsehood. It's a type of ga'ava, of haughtiness, because you're trying to convince others of something that you do not have, or present to yourself something that you do not have. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here has a nice explanation as well. It says, "B'talit shel tamid chacham lo b'talit mamash kamar." Doesn't literally mean a talit. Mishum she'kol chayavim b'tzitzit. Everybody wears a talit and tzitzit. It's been funny that he took it literally, like a talit over here, meaning that a talit in the term of tzitzit, not talit being an outer garment. Ela shekorech b'sudar al rosho ke'en shayu regilim lasot tamidei chachamim. But rather he put a turban on his head, or covered his head, the way that the tamidei chachamim did. That is mentioned in the Gemara in Kiddushin, that a young Talmid Chacham who is already reaching the point of Hora'ah should have his head covered and wear a turban around his head. I mean, there was a special type of covering that they wore. V'sudar asur lifros ki im l'Talmid Chacham. And you can't put on this turban unless you're a Talmid Chacham. V'karo shmo sudar al shmo shel Talmid Chacham. It's called the sudar. The etymology of the word is from a Talmid Chacham. K'dektiv sod Hashem le'reyav. It's an acronym for the secrets of Hashem belong to those that fear Him. And that's where the word Sudar comes from, according to this. But the idea being that they have a unique head covering that they wear that made them into Talmud Chacham. Again, today you have a similar thing in the Sephardi world. The Chachamim, or the Chacham, wears a special type of hat. You saw that when Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal, Rav Avadya Yosef Zatzal, when they were appointed as Rabbonim, that they used to wear a special type of turban or hat that represented them as being Talmidei Chachamim, or leaders. Someone to put on that hat without having that stature, without being in that league, then that would be somebody who is acting inappropriately. And again, even today, amongst the Ashkenazi world, then the Talmidei Chachamim are those that are the leaders, wear the longer jackets, indicative of the fact that they are Talmidei Chachamim, as well as the type of hat or strimal that they wear sometimes is more unique for those that are considered to be the leaders or the rabbonim. So again, someone who puts that on or takes on that dress, even though they're not a Talmud Chacham, that's a false presentation of who they are, of what their stature is, and that is considered to be unacceptable because it's, in essence, a lie. Amar Rava, Ayman dezavin lechavita dechamra lechanua. Person who sells a barrel of wine to the storekeeper, adaita lesbuye, and the intent is clearly to sell it, vitakif apalga utilta, and then it goes bad halfway through the barrel, or whether it's a third of the way through the barrel, two thirds through the barrel, a third of it goes bad, dinuhu de mekabal amine. The din is that the seller's got to take it back. He has to know that he's warranted it in that way. So now, the way that the Rishbam explains it is that the storekeeper over here never takes possession of the wine. He basically becomes a broker of sorts, or a seller of the other person's wine. He's taking it to sell on his behalf, but he never takes possession of it, and he has a right to hand it back to him if he's unable to sell it. Given that, you can't make the claim that it was the possession of the chenvani, of the storekeeper, that caused the problem here. If you hold like Rabbi Chir Bar Yosef that the mazel gorim, that means whoever is the owner is the problematic party over here. Since the storekeeper never took possession of it, he doesn't become the deemed owner of the wine, and therefore the only person that can be responsible for the wine going bad is the original owner of the wine, the one who sold it to him. So in essence, it was sold to him almost on consignment, but not literally on consignment, because there you would take possession of it when you're selling it. Over here, he's not taking possession of it at all. He's just selling it as a broker on behalf, as an agent on behalf of the wine owner. Because of that, when the wine goes bad, it is the original owner's problem and not the storekeeper's problem. That's the way Rashi explains it. The Baalei Tosafot are not comfortable accepting that because the beginning of the statement here was, Haimon Dezavin Lechavita, someone who bought or sold a barrel of wine. There was a transaction that happened here. It doesn't sound like he gave it to him to sell on his behalf. It sounds like he actually bought it. And therefore, the Baalei Tosafot believe that it is a case where he bought it literally. And the Venira lo the Faresh to marry the Zavin Mecher Gamor, but died to the Ochiz Avno. And this was the condition of the sale. Shim Karenu Bechanut, and that he'll sell it in the store. Vidami, and it's the equivalent of saying, Lamarle le Mikpeh, that I'm gonna use it for cooking. Shim Karenu Bechanut, why, the Bai Shit Kayem Kadei Mikpeh, because he needs it to last for a long time. Hakanami Beina Shit Kayem Kadei Sibuya. Over here also, you need it to last enough time that he can sell it out. So by definition, when you have someone who is giving you an item where it's clear through the transaction, from the transaction, it's clear the intent of the individual, then that is almost as if it's implicitly assumed in the sale. So over here, where had he stated explicitly he wanted to use it for cooking, it would have to last a long time. So too, when he gives it to the storekeeper, who's clear that the storekeeper is going to sell it over a period of time, that's as if it was now explicitly stated as a part of the contractual obligations that it lasts long enough for him to sell it in the store. If it goes bad before he's able to sell it off, then that was something that is the responsibility of the mocher, because there was a implicit statement of that it's got to last enough time for me to be able to sell it out in the store. So that's the way the Baalei Tosafot learn it. It's only a case where he didn't change the tap. But if he changes the tap, then that's not the case. So the way that the Rishbam seems to indicate over here is the case that he put a second tap into the barrel. He didn't use the tap that was there already. He put another tap in there. That then becomes a contributory factor in the possibility of the wine going bad. If he left everything intact, the way that he was given, in the barrel that it was given, then he can make a claim that I had no contribution in the wine going bad. The problem stemmed from your wine and not from me. Once he already starts to do things that can be deemed as pshia, that he did them improperly, and that doing them improperly contributed to the deterioration of the wine, then he no longer gets the warranty of the seller, because then he becomes a party to the problem. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it, it's not that it was a second tap, but he put the tap in the wrong place. Shelo asah samuch l'shmarim, that he put in the tap the wrong way, that he didn't do it near the sediment at the bottom of the barrel, he did it somewhere else along the barrel. So whatever he did, there was a problem in his engagement with the barrel, and then the seller can start to say that you were the cause of the problem and it wasn't the wine that went bad. Once again, it's only true if the big market day hasn't passed already. The big market day came by already, he should have sold out. The fact that he didn't sell out means that either he was doing poor advertising or he was lazy and not doing the selling on the day of the market. So yes, the seller warranties the wine for the amount of time that it will take him to sell it. But there is an assumed time where you should have finished off the wine and you should have sold it. If in the big market day, people normally finish off the barrels on those days, then the seller doesn't warranty beyond that point in time, because then it's the buyer's negligence that it wasn't sold out on that day. Now it becomes the buyer's problem. So again, here you have a balance between the parties. The seller has to warranty the wine, but the seller's warranty is no longer in effect when the buyer does something that is either negligent or inappropriate in the situation. Then they can blame it on the buyer. So that's it. When they have on electronics today or on other things today, if this seal is broken, it's no longer under warranty. So meaning that if you start to open up the item and play around with the item, then the seller says you no longer have a warranty. And that's what's happening over here as well. So as the buyer does things to the wine or is negligent in the usage of it, then the warranty is no longer applicable. Vamarava, I man de kobil chamra, adaita de mamatile, the parvata, the vol shofat. That he takes the wine on condition that he's going to transport it to the port of Dvau Shofat. You can see over here in the Beth already, he's telling you to go look in other places in Bob Metzia and the Tosfot, and about the meaning of the word Parvata, as well as what the city's name is. You can see that he brings other names like Zalar Shfat. It's not clear here what city they're referring to. From the context, it makes it clear that it was a city where there was premium pricing for wine, number one. Number two is it was further away. It was not close by. Most people think that it was along the Tigris River. It was a city along, or port city along the Tigris River. Vadamati the autumn, before he gets there, Zal, the prices dropped. So the idea was that the seller sells it to the buyer here, and the buyer takes possession of it immediately, and he buys it at the current market price where they are, but the seller insists that he go sell it in this other location, where the prices are higher. The way that Rashbam explains it over here is that this is what the Gemara calls an iska in Bava Metzia, which is that we're going to share in the profits, we're going to share in the losses, but you are going to be the active partner. Which is that you're going to buy the wine off of me, and you're going to take it to this location and sell it at the higher price, and then we're going to split the profits. Of course, you have to deal with the Gemara in Bava Metzia, how they split the profits or the losses to make sure that there's no problem of repeat over here. But that's the structure of the transaction that's taking place. On the way there, the price drops. Dinahu de mikabale. Din is that he has to accept responsibility for it. The owner of the wine is responsible for this because of the fact that he insisted that it be sold in the other location. The fact that he insisted it go to the other location, he bore, in a sense, the burden of it going to the other location because he didn't allow the buyer of his wine to sell it locally, even at a higher price. He said, you must go to this location. Because he stipulated that in the condition of the sale, that makes him responsible for it until it reaches that place. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, that's only with regards to appreciation or depreciation in the market. What it doesn't include is geneva v'aveda. If it was stolen or if it was lost, then it's in the responsibility of the receiver as well, meaning it's in both parties. Meaning that because they're partners now in this, if it's lost or stolen, the partnership loses, and both parties are in the loss here. The only thing that is not responsibility of the buyer of the wine here is the fact that the price changed. And the fact that he insisted that he take it there and wait till he gets there, that was the cause of the problem, because the price depreciated it during that transport time. Had he allowed him to sell it anywhere, the guy could have unloaded it before he got there. And even if it wasn't at a higher price, at least he would have gotten something back. Fact now that they're getting nothing for it or only getting the same price is the responsibility of the original owner. Ibailu, havachalo, mai. If it turns into vinegar, what's the din? So exactly your question. How does this appreciation in the market price relate to also it turning into vinegar? So Amar Ravilo le Ravashi, ki avin be Rav Kahana, when we were in the Beit Midrash of Rav Kahana, Amar lan chala lo. That chala is not the case. The lo k'Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Chanina. Not like Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Chanina says that when it is in the kankan of the lokeach, then it's a problem of the lokeach, but as long as it remains in the kankan of the mocher, then it remains under the warranty of the mocher. And so that's what he's saying here, is that by the case of vinegar, the balayayin does not accept any responsibility, because the mazel is what causes the problem. Now, given that the mazel causes the problem, then here you have joint ownership. So now joint ownership, joint mazel, joint responsibility for the fact that it turned into vinegar. So this is like Rabbi Chir by Yosef, not like Rabbi Yosi by Rabbi Chanino, who said that if it stayed in the barrel of the mocher, it would be the mocher's problem. Now here you have joint responsibility, and therefore you cannot blame it all on the original owner of the wine. So different than the case of appreciation and depreciation, where we say, look, he insisted that you take it there, that's why the problem arose, so it's the problem of the seller. With regards to the spoiling of the wine, since they're both owners, they are joint ownership and joint responsibility for the fact that it deteriorated, because they are partners in mazal garim. The other possibility is, v'ikadamre, afilu chalo, nami mikabel, even vinegar, the original owner is responsible, kiman, who's that like, Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Chanina. That follows the position of Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Chanina, which is if the wine remains in the barrel of the mocher, and it's being transported in the barrel of the mocher, and he insisted you take it to that location, then the balayayin is responsible for it until it reaches that location, because he was the one who insisted that it go there. And it's warranted, as long as it's in the barrel of the seller, he warranties the quality of the wine that it should reach that location. If it went bad before it reached that location, then it didn't meet the warranty of purpose that he sold it for, which was to take the wine to that location. So that same machloka that we saw before between Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Chir by Yosef about responsibility for wine will influence what the outcome here is in this case, where the seller insisted that you take the wine to a specific location and sell it there. But this explanation runs into a problem for the Balei Tosafot, who before said by the case of the Chanut that it's talking about a case where there was a full-fledged sale, but he just stipulated the fact that it's going to be sold over time, Sibuyei, over there where it's a full-fledged sale, that it's still the seller's responsibility. How come over here, where it's not even a full-fledged sale, it's a partnership, and yet we're saying that according to Rabbi Chir bar Yosef, the mazalcha goreim, and you are responsible for it, then certainly by the case of Chanut, the person should be responsible because he is the true owner. He's the only owner of the item at that point in time, and should say mazalcha goreim. So the Balei Tosafot deal with that by saying, Ve'yesh lomar, Dai lishna de muki hach milta de rava biyadua sheyeno machmitz. That one explains the case of Rava in a case where he know for sure his wine goes back. But then it's only true if he stipulated he was going to use it for selling it in Chanut. If it's not for that, you shouldn't have kept it around. So the way that Tosafot solves the problem is to say the case of Rava and the storekeeper is a case where the remainder of the seller's wine went bad and turned into vinegar. So over there, if he made that stipulation that he's going to sell it in the store over time, then he gets a warranty of purpose because he knew that he had to keep it over time. But if he didn't stipulate that, it wouldn't be an exemption because he shouldn't have kept it around. Over here, where the case is that it's not that all of his wine went bad, and therefore in the partnership you can say, mazal chag goreim, we are joint parties, and therefore we're jointly responsible because our joint mazal is what caused the problem over here. There are other Rishonim that explain this latter case similar to the previous case and therefore avoid the problem. They say just like by the case of Rova, the situation according to the Balei Tosafot is that you said that I'm going to sell it in the store, and therefore implicitly you indicated to him that you're going to keep it around, and that's why he has to warranty the wine. So too over here, the Ritva says and explained the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananel, That over here also, he bought it from him fully, but he disclosed that he was transporting it to the Parvata Deval Shafat, that he was transporting it to there. And then again, it's as if it's implicitly stated as a part of the contractual obligations here that the wine lasts until he gets there. And so therefore, in both these cases, it's a similar type of genre where he's indicating to them that he's going to be traveling with it or keeping it around for a long time. And therefore, the wine has to last, or the warranty needs to last for that period of time. And then this latter case would be very similar to the previous case, where he can't make a claim of Azachat Goreim because of the fact that he stipulated that he wanted the wine to last all the way until this location. And in both instances, the mocher, the seller, will be fully responsible for this, not a joint responsibility, because of the fact that he disclosed what he was going to use the wine for, which is almost the equivalent of saying lemikpeh, that I'm going to use it for cooking. And therefore, the seller should have known that he needed to last that period of time. If it doesn't last that period of time, then he's failed in the warranty of purpose for this particular item. And thereby avoiding the Tosfot's problem, because in the end, the cases are similar. There's a full-fledged sale with some sort of implicit information that's given, which the Balei Tosfot and other places in Shas talk about the need for disclosure. How much disclosure does a person need in order to have this be a part and parcel of the contractual sale? But over here, since they disclose what they're going to use it for, that's enough information that the seller is now obligated to warranty the product to last for the purpose of which it is being bought. All right, so now, Yashan Mishal Eshtekad, said that old or aged wine means from last year. Tana Umiyashem Olechad Achag. It has to age or keep going until Sukkot. So as opposed to what we saw in the Mishnah, that if you bought wine in this year's crop, it only has to last until Atzeret, until Shavuot, because you don't guarantee or warranty it'll go through the summer. When you buy aged wine, the assumption is that it can make the summer or through the summer, because it already did. It already went 1 year through a summer. And that means that when you buy it, you assume you're going to get another full year out of it, back to the Batsir, which is the Sukkot time. You're going to get back to that another year. So when you buy it in the second year, you expect to be able to finish out the second year. And the same thing, it seems to be, with regards to Miyushan, that if you buy it in the second year of its life, that you expect to be able to get a third year out of this to the Sukkot. Okay, next Mishnah. Amucher makom lechaveiro. Person who sells a location to his friend. Let's go with the gears of the Bach. Solo beit chano de bno, to build a location for his son to live, his married son. Ubeit amanot lebito, or to make a location for his widowed daughter. And similarly, achena mekabel makom mechaveiro, someone who gains a location from his friend, in order to solo beit chano de bno, to make a marriage house for his son. Ubeit amanot lebito, or a widow's house for his daughter. Bonet, what does he have to build him? Arba amot oshesh. That is the minimum size of such a structure is 4 by 6. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. That is the position of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, refet bakar hizo. That is a cow shed. That is not big enough for people to live in. That's where you keep cows. But it's interesting over here. We're going to see it in the Gemara. It's not clear how to read the Mishnah because it's not clear where the position of Rabbi Akiva ends and the beginning of Rabbi Shmuel's position is. You'll see because we're going to see more information in the Mishnah. And the Gemara itself will be misupak about exactly what the statements of Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva are over here. But just abstractly, it's interesting that Rabbi Akiva says that 4 by 6 is sufficient for Bama to live in. And Rabbi Shmuel's response to him is that that's a cow shed. Rabbi Akiva will say back to him, that's where my wife and I lived for the first part of our marriage. The Gemara that describes the story of Rabbi Akiva in Nidarim speaks about the fact that he was pulling the hay or the straw out of his wife's hair because they were so impoverished. And his father-in-law had cut them off because she married Rabbi Akiva the shepherd, that they were living in a cow shed. So Rabbi Akiva says, what are you talking about? That's exactly where we lived when we first got married. Just saying that as an aside, that Rabbi Akiva's standards might have been different because of Rabbi Akiva's experiences. And he says that a 4 by 6 location, that's good enough. Rabbi Shmuel says that a 4 by 6 is a cow shed. Refet Bakar. A cow shed. The question is, who's speaking at this point in the Mishnah? Reve Bakar Bone Dal Ramot Oshesh. You build a 4 by 6. So, is this the statement of Rabbi Akiva? Which means that Rabbi Akiva is saying, yes, you're right, it is a cow shed, but it's also good enough for people to live in. Yes, that's the standard that you would use for a cow shed. But, if it was a situation in which you had someone build a house like that, that would suffice for those individuals. It's not the biggest house, but it still would qualify as a house. And Rabbi Shmuel is saying, no way, that doesn't qualify as a house at all. Or is this the statement of Rabbi Shmuel? Rabbi Akiva thinks that 4 by 6 is a good house. And the statement here that 4x6 is the Refet Bakar is Rabbi Shmuel's position. That's what he's saying. That's the Refet Bakar. Bayit Katan, a small house is Sheish Al Chet, is 6x8. Gadol, a big house is Chet Al Eser, is 8x10. Truklin, a palatial type of place is Yud Al Yud, is 10x10. Seems here that the reason it's 10x10, as the Rashbam says over here, is the Moshav Sarim Asui. It's for the ministers or the princes to sit in. Veloda tashmish, but not for active usage. Hilkach miruba beina. Therefore, you make it square. So it's more of a meeting place. It's more of a place where they host individuals, but they don't have it functioning like a regular house. A regular house that functions has got to be a rectangle in order to separate out from the living quarters and the eating quarters and the processing quarters. So that's why you have to have a rectangle. But over here, where it's a house of royalty or people who are coming there only on occasion and they're meeting other people there, it's like a hosting house, there you can be square. Romo kechatzi arko uchatzi rachbo. Its height should be half the length and half the width. That should be the standard of height that you use. How do you know how high it should be? All we gave you here was measurements of length and width of the house. We didn't give you the height. So the height is based on half the length plus half the width. And many have the girsa that is found in the Mishnayot, which is kehechal, like the heichal. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel omer kebinyan heichal. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says a proof to that is the binyan heichal. You'll see that the Gemara is going to question whether Rabbi Shmuel is making a statement or he's making a rhetorical question, which is that a statement that it's similar to the heichal, because that's the way heichal was designed, that's the way a house is, or is he posing a question? Kebinyan heichal? You want to build your house the similar way to the Eichal? The Eichal is a unique structure. You don't have to have every house look like the Eichal or have the same dimensions of the Eichal. So that's two ways to read it. We'll see that in the Gemara. Gemara says something important here because society has changed so much that it feels foreign to us to make such a statement. But the Mishnah makes certain assumptions over here that are not true today in our society. Why does the Mishnah bring as examples of someone putting an addition on his house? The way that the Mishnah is describing is that he's putting an additional room on his house to take care of his young married son who needs a place to live until they can get up on their own feet and then establish their own household and then build their own house. So they give them a small room that's attached to the house. It's an extension on the house. Litnei beit chanut libno ulebito. Why is it only mentioned his son and not his son and his daughter? He also has daughters that are getting married. Why doesn't it speak about the fact that they build on an addition to the house for his young married daughter? Similarly, it says that it's a location for Beit Almanut the Bito. If his daughter was widowed, he's building an extension of the house to house his daughter who was widowed. What about the fact, Ubeit Almanut the Bno Bito? Why doesn't it say if his son was also widowed, why doesn't it say that he needs a house for his son, who a young married son who is widowed? Milta Gaborche Gamash Mulan. The Mishnah is teaching us proper etiquette, or what is considered to be the norm of society. It's not normal for the son-in-law to live by his in-laws. We'll get to this in a second. The statement in Ben Sirah that supports this idea. So what it's saying over here in the Mishnah is, it's normal for the sons to live by their parents, or the family of the son. And that means that when you're going to build for the young marriage, you're building an extension on the house. You're building it for your son, not for your daughter. The daughter goes to live by the in-laws. She becomes a part of the family that she married into. Then if she's widowed, that's why you need a place for her, because she's coming back to the father's house. Because she left the father's house and was living by her in-laws. But what you see here is that the husband is the one who dictates where they live. You live with the husband's family, not with the wife's family. Again, in today's society, it's mostly the other way around. That people tend to live closer to their wife's family, or the wife dictates where they live and not near the husband's family. It's not always true, but societally, the norm clearly has changed over here. Obviously, part of that is that they don't live literally in the house of the parties, which is that maybe if they live nearby, they don't live literally in their house. And the problem that the Gemara is raising over here is a problem of literally living together in the household. K'dichtiv b'sefer ben sirah. Sefer Ben Sirah is one of the Sfarim HaChitzonim. It's not considered to be a part of the books of Chazal, but it obviously carried a lot of weight amongst Chazal, because throughout the Gemara, Sefer Ben Sirah is quoted. Now, Sefer Ben Sirah is a compilation or composition that includes songs, poetry, mashalim, and words of wisdom. It was a compendium of knowledge. It was written in the time of the Tanaim. It seems to be in the time when the Beit HaMikdash was still extant, and was heavily read by the Tanaim and the Amoraim, who subscribed to it and quoted it in the Gemara. It really came to light with the finding of the Cairo Geniza, when Solomon Schechter, one of the things that he found there was copies of the Sefer Ben Sirah, which he was able to put back together. Are they able to at least get a lot of what was in the Sefer Ben Sirah to put it back together, where beforehand we only had it as quoted in the Gemara. So that was part of the finds of the Cairo Geniza, was this Sefer Ben Sirah. Hakol shakalte b'kof maznaim. I weighed everything on the scales. V'lo ma'ksati kal misubim. I didn't find anything lighter than bran. Over here, again, the idea that the bran is light. There are many things that are light, as the Rishbam points out. You could put feathers on a scale and that would be lighter than bran. But the intent is to say something that is psolet, something that is refuse or garbage that is now light. And that is like the subim. V'kal mi subim. And there's something even lighter than subim. Chatan hadar bebeit chamiv. That is a son-in-law that lives in his in-law's house. V'kat kal mi chatan. And it's something even lighter than that, or something that's even worse than that is, oreach machnis oreach. A guest who invites in another guest. V'kal mi oreach. And something even worse than that, or lighter than that, of a guest inviting another guest is meshiv davar b'terem yishma. Person who answers before he hears the question. He preemptively answers the question, or he cuts the person off in answering the question. Shenamar, as the pasuk says, meshiv davar b'terem yishma. Someone who responds before he hears what the question is, iveleti lo uchlima. It is foolishness for him, uchlima, and it is disgraceful or embarrassing that he does such. Because, first of all, it's foolish because he doesn't even let the other person express their thoughts. So he's answering, he doesn't even know if he's answering the right thing. And part of the foolishness is that he thinks he knows what the other person's thinking before they ever articulate that which they're trying to convey. And sometimes it might be even embarrassing or disgraceful because he's answering something that has nothing to do with what the person was asking. Ends up saying things that are not even relevant or that even are detrimental to the situation. So that here is a hierarchy that Sefer Ben Sirah speaks about things that are inappropriate or things that should not be done. So he says, subim, which is this bran or terrible flour that was put together because they didn't shell the wheat before they started to mill it. So that stuff, which is quote unquote light because it has mixed into it all of these shells and wasted stuff that is giving it heft without weight. So to over here, you have a whole bunch of items here, which are seemingly okay or seem to be fine. Nevertheless, they're very problematic. So even on the surface, they look okay. They have deep-seated problems in them, and each one worse than the other. And the first of which he mentions afterwards is a son-in-law living by his in-laws. The Gemara in other places notes that one should be careful of their first son-in-law because of the fact that there was problem of trysts between son-in-laws and mother-in-laws, whether that's physical attraction that comes about, or whether that's in terms of monetary support, that the mother-in-law gives money to the young couple and stealing from her husband and doing so, the Gemara gives both of those as the reasons. Nevertheless, there is some sort of problem with a son-in-law living with the mother-in-law that brings to suspicions, and therefore it shouldn't be set up in that way because it can lead to detrimental things. And then something even worse than that, is a guest who invites guests. In a sense, he's doing a mitzvah. He wants to be machnis orchim, but he's doing it on the back of the host because the host invited him, and now he's inviting more guests when he's not the host himself. So again, it's something where you have a pretense of a mitzvah, but meantime, you're doing something on someone else's back, which is inappropriate. And then the last one is here, where a person seemingly is addressing the other person's issue and doing it quickly, so it seems like he's really helping him out. In the end, not being patient causes it to be that the answer is not relevant or is going to be foolish, and that you're not giving respect to the individuals asking the question. And therefore, that's considered to be inappropriate or even worse than these other items. Here it's a list of items that are considered inappropriate, and amongst them is this idea of a son-in-law moving in with his in-laws, and that's why the Mishnah itself gives you that advice that you're building the house for your son in your own house, and you're building a widow's house for your daughter because your daughter would move in with her in-laws rather than stay with your family so that your son-in-law is not moving in with you. Okay, Rabbi Shmuel Omer, refit bakar hizo. That's a cow shit. The Mishnah continues. Arotze lasot refit bakar manin katani la. That next section of the Mishnah, who authored it? Ika damre, there's some that say, Rabbi Shmuel katani la. That Rabbi Shmuel wrote it. Beika damre, Rabbi Akiva katani la. Some say that Rabbi Akiva wrote the latter half of the Mishnah, or was the author of the latter half of the Mishnah. Ika damre, Rabbi Akiva katani la. Some say that Rabbi Akiva is the author of that part. Vachi kamar. That's what he's saying. Afo pishi refit bakar hi. Even though you're right, I agree it is a refit bakar. Pe'amim shadam osed dirato k'refit bakar. Sometimes people live in places that are like a refit bakar, like me. We ended up having to live there. It may not be by choice. It may not be your favorite thing. But nevertheless, sometimes you only have that choice, and you're going to live in a space that is the equivalent of a cow shed. V'ika da'amar, Rabbi Shmuel tanila. Some say that the latter half of the Mishnah is Rabbi Shmuel. V'achi kamar. Sho osed lasod refit bakar, osed arba amot oshesh. Whoever wants to make a refit bakar makes it 4 by 6. So the difference would be in how you read it is how much information we have about each person's position. If you read it in the first way that Rabbi Akiva is the author of that latter part of the Mishnah, then Rabbi Akiva is giving you information. He's first of all telling you that a refit bakar is 4 by 6. He's also telling you that a small house or a little extension could be 4 by 6. So we know both pieces of information with regards to Rabbi Akiva. And from Yishmael, we also know. We know that he agrees that it's a refit bakar by 4 by 6, but he believes that's not a bayit, that a bayit, a minimum of a bayit, is 6 by 8. And so therefore we know both of their positions with regards to both pieces of information. If, on the other hand, Rabbi Yishmael is the author of the latter half of the Mishnah, then we only know one piece of information about each of them. We know that Rabbi Akiva thinks that a beit chanut is 4 by 6. We don't know what he thinks of a refit bakar, we have no idea. On the other hand, we know that Rabbi Yishmael holds that 4 by 6 is a refit bakar, and a small house is 6 by 8, but we don't know what he thinks about a beit chanut. What is the size of beit chanut? We'd have to assume that it means a bayit katan, it would be 6 by 8, even though from the way that the Mishnah writes it, a bayit katan seems to be one step above a beit chanut. In that case, we'd only know that Rabbi Akiva thinks that that's a beit chanut is 4 by 6, and Rabbi Yishmael thinks that a refit bakar is 4 by 6, but the other way around, we don't know that other piece of information about them. So part of that would depend on whether you think that this bayit katan is synonymous with the beit chatnut, or is distinct, and who makes that statement about the bayit katan? Is that a continuation of the statement of Rabbi Shmuel now? Or is that really Rabbi Akiva's statement over here about the bayit katan? And that also would influence the girsa in the beginning of the Mishnah. We read it like the Bach, who says that at the beginning of the Mishnah is all talking about beit chatnut. The Ramban indicates that maybe the Mishnah in the beginning is talking about a regular bayit. And the reason he can build him a beit chatnut is because he didn't specify what he's looking for. If he said bayit, he can build him anything that's classified as a bayit. Beit chatnut is the smallest thing classified as a bayit. So that's yad alokeach al atachtona. In the latter half of the Mishnah where he specifies what he wants, there he has to build him exactly what he asked for. Right now, the Gemara continues. It says, traklin yud al yud. Traklin is 10 by 10. My traklin. What is this traklin? So the Gemara answers, it's kupta beivarde. It is a kuba. A kuba is like a box. Beivarde, that is full of roses. So now the Rishbam over here brings, he says, ke'en kuba shel zonot. It's like the box of zonot. It's a place where they used to keep the harlots. Benir eli shasui chalanot ke'en kuba. The reason being is that it has lots of windows. So the idea was that the harlots used to sit by the windows in order to attract their customers. So a kubashel zonot was an area that had tons of windows in it so that they could advertise their wares and attract in the customers that were there. So that's how the Rishbam explains it. And beivarde is notim shem vradim lenoi. So obviously we're not talking about a kubashel zonot, we're talking about a structure that is similar. And in that structure they used to put roses in the windows in order to make it look pretty. So it's, again, we're talking about something that is palatial, and therefore it has windows. It's talking about wealth and having roses in the windows. It's a beautiful place. That's the way that the Rishbam explains it. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, Ke'en sheporsim olim v'agulu l'mala, the kuba. It's circular. It has a kippah on top of it. Mukafu mikol d'rafav. And it's surrounded by walls. Porsim shoshanim l'sham. And they spread out roses over there. Kedei shei reicham no deif. So that their smell permeates the whole area. And then the princes sleep in that area, or they come to rest in those areas. So the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains, it's a structure that has some sort of tent or kippah on top of it. And in that area of the tent or the kippah on top, they put the roses to give a certain amount of aromatic side to this location. Fragrance that makes it smell really nice. So that's the way that he explains it. The fact is that the word truklin really comes from the word tri, which means three. And if you go up to Tzipori, you can see this, that they have a truklin that's still intact up there. This truklin was a place where you had three couches around the table, a place to eat. It was basically the dining room, but the dining room of the rich, where they had plenty of space, and then they had couches around the table. And you can see the markings for where the couches were and placed in this truklin that still exists in Tzipori today. So a truklin was, again, a building of the rich, a building where they hosted people, where they served meals to people. And it was square, again, like the Rashbam says before, because it wasn't for utility, it was for serving, it was for hosting in there. Doesn't mean necessarily that they was detached from the remainder of the house. If you go up to Tzipori, you can see it, but it's clearly a very, very separate room, and it's a big structure that almost looks like it might have been even added after the fact, which is that as people got wealthier, they added on these additions to their houses. But yes, there are separate rooms with separate utility, and they had specific purposes. And if you contract to have a truklin built, there were standards of how a truklin is built. Tane vikanter, 12x12. Then if you ask to build a kanter, that's 12x12. My kanter, what is it, kanter? Tarbatz aptane or apande. It is the tarbatz of the estate or the palace. So here, if you look in the Rishbam, he says that it is a chatzer gadol, it's a large courtyard, shosim sarim b'tzad apadnei shalem, that they make next to their large mansion, v'ashem shemarbitzim oto tamid b'mayim, because they sprinkle it with water all the time, l'shkiva avak, to keep the dust settled. So it's a very large courtyard, whether it's a gazebo of sorts, but it's clearly an open area, and it's something that is extremely large. A place where either they rested, a place where they used to go out into the garden, a courtyard or a garden that adjoined the main house. The Rabbeinu Gershom, Ginat Bitan, Shachorei Apadnam, it is the garden that is behind the palace or behind the mansion, which is Ginat Bitan HaMelech, which is referring to in Megillat Esther with the garden of the king. So there's a place where the king goes to stroll or goes to think or goes to sit outside, which is called Ginat Bitan HaMelech, and that's what he thinks that it's referring to. Now, Romo Kichatzi Erko Chatzi Rachbo, the height of the building is half the length plus half the width. Rayala Davar, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, America Biyana Echal. Rayala Davar Mani Ketanila. Who says that it's a proof to it? Ikadama Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Ketanila? Bochikamar. Some say this is all part of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position. Rayala Davar Minayin. How do we know that there is such a concept that the height should be the addition of half the length and half the width? Everything's like the Binyan Echal. Some say Tanakama Ketanila. This is what I noted in the Mishnah. Some say that the Tanakama wrote it. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Atzmuye Kametama. He is answering in a rhetorical question, which is V'achikama Leila Tanakama Raya Minayin Mi Binyan Echal. He says, "What your proof is from the Binyan Echal?" The whole world makes their house like the Binyan Echal. That's a unique structure. You don't have to mimic that structure or the dimensions of that structure or the relationships of height to width and length are not meaningful outside of the Echal. So again, I said to you that in the Mishnayot, the Girsa seems to be more explicit that the Tanakama says that Rayala Davar Mehechal, and then Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's response to them is a rhetorical response of, what do you mean? Everything has to be like the Echal. Tanya Acherim Ormim, others say, I mean, this is an alternate opinion, Romo Kikorotav. The height is the length of the crossbeams. Whatever the length of the crossbeams is, that's the measure of height. Velema Romo Kirachbo. Then why don't you just simply say that the height of the house is the width of the house? If you think of a rectangular house, and you have to run crossbeams across the house, you're going to run the crossbeams across the width of the house, not the length of the house. The reason being that it's shorter. The width of the house is shorter than the length, and to get long crossbeams is hard. So you're going to run your crossbeams for the roof across the width of the house instead of the length of the house. So what you're saying in essence is, the height of the house should equal the width of the house. So why do they say like its crossbeams? Just say like the width of the house. Says that the reason is because the houses, as they rise, narrow. Just that when you're building out of bricks and stones, you have to have a wider base and then it narrows towards the top. So if you said the width of the house, you wouldn't get the right number, because up at the top, the width is wider than the width at the bottom. So if you use the width at the bottom, you would come up with a smaller space. If I say kikorotav, I'm telling you that the width's got to be at the top of the wall, where it's much wider because the walls are narrower at the top. Or it's because of Beit Kaveh, which are the windows. Again, this is something you can see at the Kotel. If you go down to the Kotel, before they created the plaza there, if you remember, before 1967, there were houses, there were buildings right up against the Kotel. And the Kotel was one of the walls of somebody's house. And how did they place the cross beams for the house in there? They actually carved little windows into the Kotel. And you can still see them there. They're still there today. There are these carvings into the Kotel where the cross beams sat that went across. Those are called windows. Not a window like a viewing window. It's a place to seat the cross beams, a notch or some carve out that allows it to sit. So if I told you that the width of the house was the height, then you would just simply take the width of the house. Now that I'm saying it's the cross beams extend beyond the width of the living space into the walls themselves, because there are notches or areas where it sits. And again, you can see this in the Kotel. There are these notches in the Kotel that were the cross beams of the houses that were up adjacent to the Kotel. So now the Gemara says, So B'chinian went out to the city or the villages. They brought him a stira and the psukim in the Navi. K'tiv, v'bayit asher banah melech Shlomo, the Beit HaMikdash that Shlomo built, l'ashem, shishima marko, was 60 in length, v'esrim rachbo, 20 wide, u'shloshim amah komuto, and 30 high. Here you're speaking about the Eichal. The Kodesh HaKodeshim is 20 by 20. The Kodesh is 20 by 40. So the total length is 40 plus 20 is 60. And the width is 20 all along. The height is 30 amot. And that's also how we got the height of the Mikdash and the Mishnah, because the Kodesh is 40 long, 20 wide, and so half of 20 is 10, half of 40 is 20, that adds up to 30, and that's how they got that dimension of the 30 heights. Uchtiv, and the pasuk says, V'lifnei advir, esrim ama orech, v'isrim ama rachav, that the edge of the dvir, here it's talking about the Kodesh of Kodeshim, is 20 by 20, v'esrim ama komato, and it's 20 amot high. So here you have a 20 by 20 by 20. So now, is it that the height of the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Eichal, is 30 amot high? Or is it 20 amot high? That's the stira and the psukim. When it describes the area of the dvir of the Kodesh HaKodeshim, it says it's 20 amot high. When it describes the area of the Eichal, the whole Kohe Eichal, it says it's 30 amot high. Zabai Tosfot point out, Rashi in Navi says, oh, that's one possibility, is that it was an attic, or the other possibility is he says, yes, there was a step down, that the Kodesh was higher than the Kodesh of Kodeshim. That's what Rashi says. Ein Ochanami, that the front was bigger than the back, or higher than the back. Bali Tosafot said, that's not correct. He says, I don't have a chance to be Marich Khan. If you look at other places in Shas where the Tosafot deals with it, he notes why he thinks that's not the right interpretation. He answers them, Amar Lahu, Ki Chachoshi Misfata Kruvim Ulemalo. That when they talk about the Kodesh HaKodeshim, it was from the wings of the Kruvim and upwards. So the truth is, in the time of Shlomo Melech, not only did they have the Aron of Moshe, which had Kruvim on the top of the Aron, Shlomo Melech also makes freestanding Kruvim that stand in the Kodesh HaKodeshim and spread their wings out. And the Psukim tell us that they were Teman Amot high. The wings of those Kruvim, or those standing Kruvim, were Ten Amot high. So when it says 20 Amot, it means 20 Amot from the top of the wings of the Kruvim, which would total 30 and mean that the roof is the same in both places, but only enumerates the upper 20 amot that are above the Kruvim's wings. My Kamash Malan. Why would the Navi go out of its way to explain it that way? Just say 30 amot. What do you need to tell me? It's 20 amot above the wings of the Kruvim. The Kamash Malan, the Mata Kilamala. That the down below is no different than above. Malamala ain mishamesh klum. Aftamata ain mishamesh klum. Just like up above, there's empty space. Above the wings of the Kruvim, there's nothing there besides airspace. So too down below, there's nothing there besides airspace. What the Gemara is going to go on to explain, which we'll deal with in tomorrow's daf, is that the Aron didn't take up any space. Which is the miracle of the Aron in the Beit HaMikdash, was that even though it was present, it was as if it wasn't present. And that's what the Limud is teaching you. Just like the upper 20 amot have nothing in them, so too the lower 10 amot have nothing in them, even though there was something there, which was the Kruvim and the Aron. And that comes to teach us about the miracle that the Aron didn't take up any space. Eino min amida. It doesn't take up, it's not counted in the dimensions, because it's as if it doesn't exist. And obviously the message behind that is that even though we're talking about a physical object, we're talking about a physical object that represents the greatest metaphysical or spiritual manifestation of God in the world. And if that's the case, then it doesn't take up space to indicate that it's not real. It's not something that's tangible in the end. Something that's completely intangible, even though it really is a tangible item. So I think that's represented by this idea that it doesn't take up any space. As I will stop here, three lines down on the top of Sadi Teremot Aleph.